My name is Jennifer, and I'm an alcoholic.
Jennifer.
I want to thank Larry for asking me to speak, and I want to welcome the newcomer. It took a lot of courage to stand up and say your name. It's funny, this year I've really have gotten to know what courage means, and even though it's probably something I should have learned long ago, it has really resonated with me, and that is doing something regardless if I have fear. And I used to think courage was doing something when fear left. So I really look at people with courage with a different eyes. I want to welcome or congratulate the people who took the cake and the two people who took 90-day tokens. Thank you. My sobriety date is March 26, 1994, and my home group is Battery Chargers, and my sponsor is Connie Sneed. And I asked if I could say that here. Some meetings, they don't like identifying other groups, but I'm proud of those things. It means a lot to have this much time, because the things I've learned today didn't come from the first 30 days or the first week. It happened over time and through my spiritual experiences as an educational variety, not burning bushes type situations. So I'm gonna tell you a little bit of how it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I was born the youngest of five girls in my family. I believe that I was born alcoholic. I believe this is something that, as the book I've learned, is an illness, a spiritual malady. And when I work my fourth step, it tells me my resentments is from it stems all forms of spiritual disease. So I got all those things over time, but I do believe I was born with this condition. I did not have alcoholic parents. I did not have alcoholic grandparents. And I'm really unsure where the first thinking came from when I wanted to drink so much as to black out. But so my early childhood was very rough. I was very hyperactive. I was put on medication very early in my childhood. I had very bad teeth, and I had all metal capped, silver metal capped teeth, and I felt very less than and felt very not a part of any of my other friends at school at a very early age. My mother... We didn't know it then, but as my sisters talk, we think now what suffered from depression and maybe a little bit of bipolar. She struggled, and she did the best she could raising us with dad. But you know, throughout my childhood, she yelled all the time. Everything was very, very stressful for her. So I grew up feeling like nothing I did was good enough. So throughout the years, there was no alcohol in the house. Maybe at Thanksgiving or Christmas time or New Year's, maybe a bottle of wine. I got a sip here and there and got to taste it. But what I did learn growing up is that when I had high levels of emotion and I was out of control, they gave me a pill. And I learned that it wasn't okay to be upset or have a high level of emotion throughout my whole childhood. So my first drunk was when I was 10 years old. My sister was getting married, and at her wedding reception, my parents had a case of champagne and a keg of beer. And when the adults would set down their drink and dance, because there was a live band, I would walk around and finish everybody's drink that they sat down. Now, I really don't know where that thinking came from. My sisters didn't try to get me to do it. I didn't know to do it from friends. I just, when I took that first drink and that warm feeling, and then the thinking and the feelings took over me, that warm feeling of, oh, I'm good enough. It was the first time in my entire life that I felt good enough. And then the second feeling, oh, I'm smart. Oh, I'm pretty. And I knew right then I made a decision that that was my best friend, and I was going to seek that out as much and as often as possible. And consequently, I drank that day so much that I blacked out. Like our 10-minute speaker, I woke up the next morning in my bed and don't really remember what happened the rest of that day. And that was my first drinking experience, and I blacked out from the very first experience. So like I told you, there was no alcohol in my house, and it was really hard for me to get alcohol at age 10. And so so when my family moved and I started junior high, and we moved to a different state and a different town, I made a decision that I was going to make friends with the baddest chick in school and make sure, you know, her parents drank. And I was going to have her teach me how to smoke cigarettes and inhale smoke. And this, I'm 11 years old. I don't know where this thinking came from, but my reasoning was, when I'm at a party and a joint is passed to me, I'll know how to inhale and I won't look stupid. My number one biggest fear at age 11, looking stupid. So, you know, that's exactly what I did. I found this girl, her parents drank, I became best friends, she taught me how to smoke, and I proceeded to spend my school life picking my friends based on if their parents drank so that I could spend the weekends with them and we could drink out of their liquor cabinet because my parents did not have that. And, you know, it didn't work even the second or the third time. And I remember going to the high school dances. My parents were extremely strict. And I had to lie to get out of the house early so that I could go to that party before the dance, so I would lie and say that my date was taking me out to dinner. So therefore, I would go to this party on an empty stomach and start drinking. And by the time we got to the dance, I'd be in a blackout and out of control and overly yelling, talking, running onto the stage where the band is, or breaking something. Or I think I walked through a window one time. You know, I don't know how I got all cut up. And that was typically my drinking career. My whole high school, I would have incomprehensible, demoralizing behavior. I would come to school on Monday, and I would not be able to look at you. My head would be hanging because I don't really know what I did, and I had girlfriends that would tell me what I did, and it was just embarrassing, and it was horrible. And so I met this girl who told me that she gave me these white crosstop pills, and she said, if you take these, you can drink longer. And I did. And this was one of my first methods of trying to control and enjoy my drinking by mixing it with speed. So I did. I'm going to backtrack a little bit. I took Ritalin until I was 10, which Ritalin is speed. I stopped it for 2 years, you know, because it quit working, and then I self-medicated on speed from age 13 on up. So I was basically on that most all my life with alcohol. So then I got introduced, you know, doing alcohol and taking speed, and that worked for a while. Everything stopped working eventually, but what it did was the thrill wasn't there, so the speed led to smoking pot, and smoking pot led to taking mushrooms, and you know, each time I would do something, you know, alcohol was always the steadfast. Alcohol was my best friend and my companion. You know, in high school, I figured out how word gets around of which stores sell to minors, and I found the adults who would buy alcohol, like just going to a dealer's house. I would go to their house, I'd give them the money, I'd sit in their living room, they'd go down to the liquor store, buy me a fifth, come back up, give it to me, and I'd leave. And we knew the adults that would do that. And I just can't even believe that any adult would do that for a kid in high school, buy him alcohol. You know, I found him, and of course that's how I live my life. So let me see, where am I? I barely graduated high school. When I was 16 and living at home, I was the last child of five. All four had grown and gone and moved out of the house, and I was out of control. You know, one of the things that I did during high school is my demoralizing behavior was sexual as well. I would sleep around as a 16-year-old girl in high school, which then that was another reason I couldn't really look you in the eye when I walked into school on Monday, because I really didn't know what I did that weekend. And sometimes I did know and didn't want to look you in the eye because I didn't really want to connect that that's what we did. And that behavior was so out of control, and my mother knew that, and I was out of control with my drinking and my drug use, that at 17, she couldn't handle it anymore, and she kicked me out of the house, and she said, you need to get out. You cannot be in this house. So at 17, I moved in with my 21-year-old boyfriend and thought that I'd arrived. This was it. I have it going on now. And, the other behavior didn't stop. And pretty soon, and I lived in a very small town up in Washington State, and pretty soon I started going to friends' house that didn't want me over at their house because I probably tried to sleep with their husband or did, you know. And then I had parents that had locked the door and took away the key, and I had cut myself off from my high school friends, and I could no longer be with my boyfriend. And I started pointing the finger at everybody and saying, you know, this town's too small and it's all your fault. And I did my first geographical, and I moved back to Sacramento, and I moved in with my oldest sister, who is a daily drinker, still is. And the party was back on. But, you know, it didn't take very long for me to start the cycle again. I moved to a new town. I start drinking. I start doing the demoralizing behavior. I start finding the people who can find me the drugs so that the drinking can continue without the blackouts. I start doing the sexual behavior, and I start pointing the fingers at people. It's all your fault. I met a man in this town. It was actually a small town out of Sacramento called Placerville. It was a very small town, and I met a man there when I was 19 or 20, and we dated 6 weeks, and we decided it was a good idea to get married. So we went up to Lake Tahoe and got married, and this man ended up being very abusive. He would beat me up on a regular basis, and he introduced me to what we called then crank, and he introduced me to needle usage. Now, I remember doing my drugs and alcohol in high school, and I would look down my nose at people who smoked pot. This is before I smoked pot, and I go, I've never smoked pot. And then I smoked pot. And then I looked down my nose at people who would take LSD or mushrooms, and, you know, the first time I took mushrooms, I forgot about me looking down my nose at those people. And, you know, my final frontier in my mind was I would never stick a needle in my arm. And there I did. I stuck a needle in my arm because I was never going to be a junkie. And so that lifestyle, that behavior, and those people we surrounded ourselves with, and my husband going to jail, robbing liquor stores. I mean, it was a completely out of control lifestyle, but it was the only one I knew. And don't ask me how I knew that, because it was not my upbringing. It was not my childhood. So again, I started pointing fingers at everybody and blaming them. And I did my second geographical. I moved from Placerville to Sun Valley, Idaho. Sun Valley, Idaho's population is 500. Now, by this time, my self-esteem was so low that that's all I could handle. I had to be a big fish in a small pond because I had no self-esteem. So I go to a small town in Sun Valley, Idaho, and I get a job. And again, the same behavior goes on. I don't recognize this as a pattern or a behavior. I start drinking. I'm completely strung out on crank, crystal, and cannot find any of it in Sun Valley. So the next best thing is cocaine. So I'm drinking, and I'm doing cocaine, and I'm doing all the other behaviors that brings me incomprehensible demoralization. And I run myself out of three jobs in 4.5 years, and my money. And my parents had just co-signed for a car for me, and I was behind a car payment. So I started doing that finger-pointing thing. You know, this town's too small. It's all your fault. I don't fit in here. And I did my third geographical, one, two, three, fourth geographical, down to Santa Ana. And I had met a man in Idaho who lived in San Diego, but I only got as far as Santa Ana to try to follow him. And I'm telling you, it only took me 6 months to do the same behavior, to do the same thinking, and finally make it down here to San Diego to be with the love of my life. So I thought, and he was an alcoholic, and we worked very well together. And what ended up happening when I was introduced with the cocaine usage is it's very expensive, and I came here with $50, and I didn't have any money. So in order to get what I wanted, alcohol and cocaine, I had to hook up with the people who could supply that to me. So I figured the best thing I could do was to be the drug dealer's girlfriend. And you know, when I did that, in my thinking, I thought I had arrived. I thought, oh, this is it. And it was. It was it for maybe a week. You know? And that's like the story of my life. I would struggle for weeks and months and years, and then I would get that, oh, I feel good enough, I feel smart enough, I feel pretty enough, and then the other alcohol I drank would kick in, and I'd go over the top, and that I would glimpse that feeling for about 30 seconds, you know, and it never lasted, and it wasn't real. So I'm the drug dealer's girlfriend, and I think I have it made, and it's what I wanted to grow up and be, not. And at this time, you know, when we moved in together, I had a pretty good job. I had kept a job here, and slowly I watched, and I think I was a little more aware. I slowly watched my stuff go away, my car get repossessed, and my boyfriend stopped coming home for days at a time, then weeks at a time. Getting fired from my job, stopping eating, getting a little too thin, sickly thin, starting to get some sores. Now, I don't have any way of making money, and I'm not employable at all. Nobody's going to hire me. I really did try to go on some job interviews, and I couldn't leave the house until I had a beer and hit a crack, because by this time, crack cocaine was so much affordable than regular cocaine, and it was so accessible. So I couldn't leave the house without at least a beer and a hit a crack, and I actually went to some job interviews, and I used to always get hired. First interview was never an effort, and I always wondered why I wasn't getting hired. And so it became apparent to me that I had to sell things around the house, the TV, the stereo, to get my needs met. So I would take the TV, I think that was the biggest, quickest seller, down to either the pawn shop or the dealer, and I would get, like, let's say $50. So with this $50 in my mind, I would negotiate, how many rocks of crack cocaine can I buy, a fifth of vodka, a pack of cigarettes, and I'd be left with a dollar, and I would negotiate with my hand in the dollar. I'll buy a hamburger at Burger King, and that would be it for a couple of 2-3 days. And then I would look around the house and say, what else can I hog? And this was my spiral down, and this was my best thinking and my best choices, and I really thought I was doing okay. And when I stopped having stuff to sell and hawk, I had friends that said, well, we can do credit card fraud, or, you know, we can start writing bad checks, and I can go into my mom's house and grab her checkbook, and we started doing little crimes just so that I could have my crack cocaine and my fifth of vodka and my pack of cigarettes and a dollar hamburger. And I, as you can see, emotionally, I'm starting to see and hit a bottom here, and during the course of this year and a half of living with my drug dealer boyfriend and making these wonderful choices in life, I had cut myself off from my parents, my mom and my dad, who still lived in Washington State. And I had really pretty much kept in contact with them on a weekly basis. I'd call home, just, you know, say, hi, how are you doing? I hadn't talked to them for over 6 months. And my mother was becoming extremely worried. She knew I was in San Diego. And so what she was doing is she was calling the San Diego Police Department, and she was begging them to find her daughter, because she didn't know where her daughter was, and she didn't know if her daughter was dead or alive. And, you know, as big as San Diego is, it's like, you know, we'll do what we can, but they don't really do anything. And my sister up in Washington researched my last residence and called the landlord and said, is Jennifer still living there? And what I had done is I had lived there previously, moved away, and then I came back. So I just happened to be living on one of the properties of this landlord, and he told my sister where I was living. And my mom called the police, and she sent the police to my door, and they're knocking on my door, and I open up, and they go, are you Jennifer? And I said, yes. And they said, your mother called, and she's worried about you. And I just looked at them, and I'll tell you, that was part of my bottom. that hurt me so bad that I had worried my mom that much. It was embarrassing to my ego, my high self-esteem and self-worth was just hit, and it really hurt that I'd done that to my mom. So they wanted to come in and they wanted to get me help, and I said, no, I don't need any help, and no, you can't come in, and I shut the door. But it started the seed of thinking, is this what I want to be, and is this what I want to do? And my friends around me started getting arrested. And I knew in my heart that I was next. At some point, I was next. And I had the friends that I was surrounded with, you know, people I was using and drinking with, talked about AA. They had been in AA, or they'd been in a recovery home. I'd never heard of AA. And they talked about meetings and detox. And so I got the gist of where I might get some help. Now, I knew how to get help on a county-funded level. I had done 3 geographicals. I'd moved into YWCAs, and the county had fed me and housed me. So I knew what to do, and I started calling around to these recovery homes and trying to interview over the phone if I could come in. And, you know, I know they knew I was, you know, I was trying to pull something over on them. None of them let me in or even asked me to come down and fill out an application. But I called 1111 Island, and they said, well, why don't you just come on down, check it out? You know, so they're like pulling one over on me. So I go, okay. So, you know, I went down, and they actually let me fill out this application for Sobriety House. And they said, you know, you're not sober. And I said, no. And they said, well, you have to be sober before we're going to let you in this recovery home. Why don't you go into 10 Day first, which was an in-house patient program. So I went over to 10 Day. And they said, well, can you stop drinking for 3 days? And I said, no, I can't. And they said, well, then you need to go to detox. I thought, oh, geez, detox. I remember driving by 1111 Island, going to go get some alcohol or score some drugs, and looking at those people out there smoking cigarettes and talking and laughing. And I'd look down my nose at them and go, what a bunch of losers. You know, I just never thought ever that anything of alcoholics. So when they told me I had to go to detox, you know, I thought, okay, you know, I got the number. I walked over there. There was no beds. So I thought, you know, okay, whatever. So I went home, and I kept trying to call recovery homes to get in. And my phone got cut off because of lack of payment. And, you know, there was a notice on the front door that we were going to be kicked out of this apartment. Rent hadn't been paid. Not that I was in charge of the bills. My drug dealing boyfriend was, but I hardly saw him. So I just assumed he paid the bills. But when we got the eviction notice, it was very clear that he hadn't been paying rent. So I decided that maybe I should go into detox. At least I'll be fed and housed, and I'll clean up my act, and I'll leave this man, and I'll go to Las Vegas, and I'll become a dealer. So that was my big master plan. So I called detox every day for 3 days, and they had a female bed available, and I went down there. And you know, the funny thing is, when I walked in the door, even though I had all those thoughts and that plan, when I walked in the door, there was a sense of that I had arrived at home. I felt welcome and warm and safe, and I thought, well, maybe this isn't so bad. So I spent 6 days there in county detox, and these people would come in at night and bring a meeting. I know it to be H&I, but these people would come in and they would talk about being clean and sober, and I would think, wow, why would anybody ever want to be clean and sober? You know, I understand I kind of am down on my luck, but why would anyone want to have 6 years, you know, or 6 months? And then they talk about God, and I thought, there is no possible way I'm going to be doing this. I don't believe in God. I think God is weak. I think religion is weak. I'm not doing this deal. And I didn't want to hold their hands, and I didn't want to say the Serenity Prayer, and, you know, I'm a little better than all that. You know, I still had that really high ego and the very low self-esteem. But, you know, after 6 days, and I felt the initial feelings of detoxing and how great that felt, and they were encouraging me to go into the 10-day in-house, I said, okay. You know, I still had no place to go. I was completely homeless. I walked in. sucked up sores and a bag of clothes. And I really, still, with all that, thought I had it going on. It's just baffling how this spiritual malady, this illness is. So I went over to the 10-day program, and I was just clean and sober enough to start to get that inner fear. I would wake up in the morning, and I would get that feeling, like, oh, no, what am I going to do without a drink in my hand? I didn't know how I was going to get through a day, or how I was going to interact with people, or how I was going to be without at least having some level of a buzz, some alcohol buzz that took the edge off of not feeling good enough. So I didn't know how I was going to get through the day without a drink, and I would have that little feeling in my stomach and the feeling after it. And I told the counselor there that I feel that way. And he says, how many times do you feel that way? And I said, probably like 15 to 25 times a day. Like every 20 minutes I feel that way. And he says, that's your obsession. And he said that you need to pray to God to remove your obsession for alcohol. And I said, oh, well, I'm not an alcoholic. And I don't believe in God either. So I'm not going to do that. And he goes, well, you know, it doesn't matter. He'd do it anyway. So, you know, I was just open-minded enough, I guess. I don't know, desperate enough that I did it. I prayed to a God I didn't believe in to remove an obsession I didn't believe I had. And I did this 15 to 25 times a day. And at 45 days sober, I woke up and I didn't have that feeling. And I haven't had it since. And I got my very first glimpse at there might be a God, because of my own decision making and of my own thinking and of my own actions, nothing has ever worked. My best thinking got me to 1111 Island, and when I walked in the doors, I felt like I was home. So I thought these people might have something. By the time 45 days had passed, I was okay holding hands. You know, it's you can only be, I'm not doing that for so long, and you really feel. You kind of want to be a part of these people. And I started to see that it was working in other people. Now, living in Sobriety House, I went from 10-day to Sobriety House. We were required to go to 3 to 4 meetings outside, do all the in-house stuff. So I was going to at least 7 meetings a week, mostly Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't believe I was an addict, so I would go to these meetings, closed or open, didn't matter, and I'd say, my name is Jennifer and I'm an addict. You know, because I thought that being an addict was better than being an alcoholic, and my self-esteem couldn't handle being lower than I already was. So I was an addict. Everywhere I went, I was an addict. And, you know, I would sit there in these meetings, and I would hear people share, and I would go to speakers' meetings, and it would be a man or a woman. It would be an older man, an older woman, younger woman, doesn't matter. They were telling my story at the podium. They were calling themselves an alcoholic. And I was sitting out there listening and nodding my head and going, yeah, 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 and still not knowing or thinking that I was an alcoholic. So finally, at about 5.5 months clean and sober, I got another one of those spiritual experiences where I'm nodding my head going, yeah, and then it goes, oh, I'm an alcoholic. And then that little fear feeling came back. Oh, no. And I thought, I have sat here and wasted 5.5 months in this recovery home. I've not worked a step. I did not get a sponsor. I haven't done anything but just use off the county and didn't do anything to help myself except go to a meeting a day for 7 days. But you know what? It takes what it takes. But after that meeting was over, I couldn't get a sponsor fast enough. I ran to this woman that I had heard share every week, asked her to be my sponsor. She said yes, and she gave me the first step. And the first step, she had me write out my whole calendar of my first drink until the day I quit. And I got to see the progression of this illness. I got to see that when I took my first drink and got drunk when I was 10, I would no way have smoked a joint that day or stuck a needle in my arm or drink every day or on the weekends. And I got to see how progressive this became and the things I was willing to do, which I wasn't willing to do the month previous or the year previous, up to doing crimes. And, you know, I got to see that, okay, this is progressive. And then I got to see She had me write out at least 6 examples of the most, I could have wrote out 25, incomprehensible demoralization acts I did. She had me write them down because she said, in the book it says that there will come a time where we, without any sufficient memory or force, we cannot bring into our minds the suffering and humiliation of even a week ago, and we're without defense against that first drink. She knew I didn't have a God in my life, and she said, you need to carry around these incomprehensible demoralizations, and if you think you can have a drink, start reading what you did. Then she had me write out all the stuff that hadn't happened to me yet, and she said, I want you to title this your yets, because if you go out drinking again, this is what you will do. Because of the progression, this is what you still have yet to do. So I started talking to her about, you know, junkies, like, oh, I'm not a junkie. And she goes, well, did you stick a needle in your arm? Well, you know, a couple of times. And she goes, well, you might not be a junkie, but she said, normal people don't stick a needle in their arm even a couple of times. So she really squashed any belief I had of thinking that I could control and enjoy drinking. I fully conceded into my heart through working step one with this woman that I was an alcoholic and that my life was unmanageable and I could never successfully drink again. And that was that. I went through a depression. You know, alcohol was my best friend. It gave me everything that I never had. It gave me all my self-esteem. It took away all my inhibitions. It took me everywhere. It took me through husbands and boyfriends and adventures, and to be just raw now was really hard. So then came step two, and she sent me to Joe and Charlie. I don't know if anyone's gone through a Joe and Charlie workshop, but I'll tell you what I learned with Joe and Charlie. They said that they made a little joke about God and the higher power where the evils of the world hid it, and they hid it in a place where man would never look. And they talked about hiding it in the highest mountain. Oh, no, we'll find it in the deepest sea. No, we'll eventually find it. They said, we know where we'll hide it. We'll hide it in the hearts of every alcoholic. They'll never think to look there for God. And then it says in step two, and we agnostics, that that's in the final analysis. That's where we find God. And then in we agnostics, it says either God is everything or he's nothing. And that's taken me a long time to come to terms. I didn't really, you know, the first time I worked step two, believe that, but today my higher power, my God, is everything. It's the weather, it's the chair I sit in, it's my sisters, it's everyone here, it's the air I breathe, it's everything. It's everything that happens good, it's everything that happens that I conceive is bad. And when I can think of God that way, then I think of everything as spiritual. It's been a long time. My spiritual experience has been of a educational variety. It's not any of these miraculous burning bush things. You know, I didn't fly out of bed or lightning or anything. But, you know, when people say that we only have as much time as whoever woke up earliest this morning, and I don't agree. It's taken me this long to think this way. It didn't happen because I got up at 6 a.m., you know, and so when she got me to work step three, boy, that was hard because I came from a family where my mother ruled with iron fist and she made things happen and she was the controller and she raised 5 girls. And to break that, I still struggle today that I'm not in control. It's okay if I sit back and allow you to be you. I don't have to tell you how to live and I don't have to tell you how to think, but you know, I still want to. It's still in my thinking, and I have to remember in step three that God's running the show, not me, and it's okay if I don't say anything or if I don't do anything. And if I do decide to say something or to do something, I can ask God for guidance first. And I've learned that only through the steps. So step four was great. I got to take everybody's inventory that I pointed my finger at over the years. I got to write it out page after page. This asshole did this and this girl did that. And, you know, my column four, my part, was pretty empty. And she spent 5.5 hours that day going over my part. It was hard. You know, I had so much denial and so much to learn. But when I left, when I finished that fourth and fifth step with my sponsor, I really learned that I had a part in everything. In everything. I stepped on the toes of my fellows not even meaning to, like telling them how to live and think because I think I know better than them, and they retaliate. And then I'm writing them on my fourth step because I don't realize that I actually was the one that caused that to happen. So six and seven for me is a lifetime journey. I discover my character defects all the time, and they're not the blatant ones that were the big chunks or the outer layers of the onion. It's little subtle things that come into my mind that cause me emotional pain, and I think, oh, can't do that anymore. But in six and seven, my sponsor tried to tell me that I was selfish and self-centered, and then that was the root of all my problems. And I didn't really see that either. So what she would do is we would go to meetings together, and anything I would say or do, she goes, that's self-centered, that's selfish, that's self-centered. And anything I'd share with her, she would point out every time what was selfish and self-centered. And I got to think and learn what's selfish and self-centered, because that's the only way I lived my life. I picked friends based on what you could do for me. And I did everything in life what served me. So to turn those wheels backwards was a very slow process, and she had to point it out for it to be obvious to me. I needed someone to point it out. She didn't lead by suggestion. She, the sponsor, I don't have her today, was exactly what I needed for those steps. After six and seven, she went away. She actually went back out. And I had to find another sponsor. And I went to her sponsor, and I worked eight and nine. And I won't get into a lot of that, but I did not connect with her sponsor. So then I dropped her, and I was without a sponsor for about a year and a half. But I had learned enough. I was 2 years, 10 months sober. I had learned enough that I knew that if I didn't get a sponsor and finish these steps, I was going to drink again. So I started going to a women's meeting, and I met my sponsor who I have now. I've had her ever since, and she took me through steps 10, 11, and 12. So when she took me through step 10, we did another fourth and fifth, and then she taught me how to do daily, morning, and nightly inventory based on the big book, reviewing my day, pausing and asking for help, writing down my inventory asset list, defects of character that I participated in, do I owe an amends? And step 11, my sponsor's really big on step 11, and what she's had me do, I don't do it every day, but what she assigned to me when she gave me step 11 is she said, you need to do 5 things for other people without them knowing it. You cannot have your ego gratified, so you have to do like random acts of kindness anonymously. And do you know that it was so hard to find 5 things to do each day? I'm so selfish and self-centered. I can't think of 5 things in a 12-hour period. But you know, the thing was, is I would seek it out, and if I got 3 of them done, that was great. And then she said, but you can't tell me because you can't gratify your ego. You just got to do it. You just got to let me know you're doing it. And that's an ongoing assignment. You know, if I get into self too much, I need to start doing that. And then we did step 12. And the thing that she told me about step 12 and being of service, going to the same meeting, sitting in the same chair, people look at over that same chair, oh, there's Jennifer, there's a reliance there, you know, there's this feeling, a good feeling that I'll be there every week. Making coffee, set up, H&I, you know, answering phones at AA Central, that's all great, she said, but now it's time to sponsor. She said, you've been given freely for 3 years now. And now it's time for it's your turn to give back. And I said, oh, geez, I can't sponsor. I have nothing to give. And she said, if you don't sponsor, it'll be one of the most selfish acts you can do in AA by taking and not giving back. So she brought me my first 2 sponsees because she knew I probably wouldn't have got any. And she goes, here, there you go. And it was great. I called her every day. She said this. She said that. What do I do? I started going to, she said, go to a newcomers meeting, raise your hand that you're a sponsor. So it was a Sunday morning, and every Sunday morning I'd raise my hand, and I had like 6 sponsees. And then Monday I'd be back down to my 1, you know. And then sometimes out of these 6, 1 would stick, and I'd work steps 1 or 1 and 2, and then she'd go away. And then the next week I'd get other sponsees, because it was a huge meeting, lots and lots of newcomers. And so for like 3 years, I'm working steps 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3. No one is going through the steps with me. And I asked my sponsor, Connie, what is going on? Why can't I work the steps with women? And she goes, because God wants you working 1, 2, and 3. When it's time to work the rest, you'll have one. And very shortly after, I did. And I would say between now and then, I have sponsored so many women, and I've taken so many women through the steps. And I have to tell you, it's one of the biggest gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to have this newcomer who doesn't know what to do, is kind of frightened, and asks me to sponsor him, and I take him through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see the light come on in their eyes, and I see them get their own higher power, not mine, and I see them make choices and build their program, and then finish the steps and start sponsoring, and it's like a little family. And it's the best family. I love my AA family. I have a couple of sisters that came here tonight to support me. I have a couple of women that came from my women's group to support me. And those are also gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't believe the time that went by. I was telling Larry, I'm not going to fill up 50 minutes. I'm just not. But I wanted to also say that in sponsoring, I would say once I started sponsoring, my life completely grew. My whole program and my life just took off. And I have to say that of my own thinking, and if I didn't go through this program or go to sponsor, I'd be drinking today. And I get into these little fits of self-pity, and life's not fair, and you know, I hate all of you, And I'll call my sponsor, and I'll start, you know, on my pity pot, I'll start crying to her, and she'll go, Jennifer, you're right. Life's not fair, because if it was, you'd be in jail. You'd be in jail. So you need to be grateful for what you have. And she said, and you'd have some kind of disease, because that would be the fair trade for all the things you did. But, you know, I've had someone with me before I even thought I did, as far as a higher power goes, who watched over me, who gave me lessons to learn and gave me gifts. And through Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm able to recognize that and stay sober. And thank you.